the call by some parts of South Florida to join the rest of the state in reopening. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Fort Lauderdale and Palm Beach County leaders do not think they should remain closed like the rest of the region, but a local health department official says not yet. Are there cracks in the collaboration among South Florida? Are some areas ready to reopen while others aren't? The mayor of Fort Lauderdale will be with us this hour. Meantime, this will be the second weekend. Parks, golf courses, and marinas are open across the region. One popular park on South Beach had to be closed because too many people were not following the rules. And will the long lines return at marinas? Plus, the life of Don Shula. Your phone calls coming up on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN, made possible by Willie the Bee-Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Well, some South Florida officials are calling for reopening South Florida and reopening soon. Today, as we're live on this Friday afternoon, the Palm Beach County Commission voted 4-3 today to tentatively reopen county beaches to residents on May 18th. WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus is reporting the commission will meet again on May 15th. To consider that decision again. Well, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach counties were excluded from the governor's first phase of reopening the Sunshine State that began on Monday this week. It's because our area still leads the state in the number of positive cases of COVID-19. Monroe County, the Florida Keys, well, they were able to join the rest of the state in the phase one of reopening. Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez announced on this Friday that the county is planning to begin reopening some businesses. He said the target date in Miami-Dade County, May 18th. Palm Beach County commissioners, as we've said, have tentatively voted to reopen county beaches for residents on that same day. WLRN asked listeners what they thought about these efforts to reopen.
My name is Isabella Marie Garcia. I live in the West Broward area of Pembroke Pines. I believe we really need to be putting our efforts not on reopening, but more so on looking at how our healthcare workers are faring, how are their supplies looking, how are they emotionally, how are they being paid, how are our grocery store employees being compensated, do they have hazard pay, Instacart, all these individuals that are working at the moment because it is an essential job for them to do so and they have no other option of working remotely. How can we help them instead of wanting to leave our homes and like escape, you know, our home setting?
What do you think about the reopening efforts here in South Florida? Phase one happening just a week ago in Miami-Dade County and in Broward and Palm Beach counties with parks, county parks and golf courses, marinas reopening. Now some voting here on this Friday, possibly reopening beaches in some locations for residents only. Give us your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN as we're live on this Friday afternoon across the region. 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN is our handle. Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trentalis sent Governor Ron DeSantis a letter this week asking to reopen his city. The mayor joins us now on the line here at WLRN. Mr. Mayor, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Tell us about your letter to the governor. You mentioned that Fort Lauderdale has a plan for reopening businesses. Walk us through that plan, would you?
Great. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me on your show again. It's always a pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to have an honest conversation with the community about where we stand at this point. You know, back in early March, when we were first starting to hear this about the seriousness of this infection, my city, along with Miami Beach, partnered to close our beaches down for fear that the disease would be spread not just within our own community but throughout the country as spring breakers came to our cities, and we didn't know how this disease was really being spread, and we were the first beaches in the country, actually the first cities, to close our beaches. And then we continued to close hotels and restaurants and bars because we realized we had to stop this disease in its tracks. So we've since been watching the track record of our actions. For example, we've been watching that curve that everyone talks about and see how it applied to our counties and to our cities. And the governor himself has pointed out how we never really reached that peak. Our experience has been more of a flatline experience, and so we really didn't have to suffer through so much of what other communities in this country had suffered. So the CDC and Dr. Fauci, who is our representative here in Broward County from the state health department, gave us ideas on how we are to think about moving forward. There were five tests that we were told we had to achieve in order to ensure that we could go into that phase one that the CDC indicated was the beginning of the reopening of our communities. Long story short, Dr. Fauci said we had achieved four of the five, and those were basically a 2 to 3 week decline in infections and in symptoms that these hospitals were experiencing.
Before we get to the fifth one that the doctor talks about, Mr. Mayor, let me ask you just about the inputting data that has allowed the county health department and your assessment to say that you've gotten four of these five criteria for reopening Fort Lauderdale satisfied. Are you looking at solely Fort Lauderdale, city of Fort Lauderdale, COVID test results, or are you looking at Broward County? Tell us, what are the inputs into that?
They're Broward County test results.
Okay, so not isolated just to Fort Lauderdale.
No, because those we don't think we have those statistics as available as we do Broward County. And these are basically coming from the state records as they keep them every day. And there's no reason to believe that Fort Lauderdale is any different than the rest of the county. So
what's the fifth criteria that you're focused on here?
So the fifth criteria specifically says that we are to have robust testing for healthcare workers and also begin antibody testing. So and what concerns me is that we do have robust testing for everybody, and not just for healthcare workers. There's never been a healthcare worker who's been denied the ability to have a test. And the idea of antibody testing is really odd because we just this week received antibody test kits, and yet the governor opened up 64 other counties in this state with no regard to the antibody testing.
It's true, right? So, but those 64 other counties had significantly different profiles when it came to infection rates and fatality rates for COVID-19. But on this robust testing piece first, let me ask you, what exactly does that mean? Is that defined at all robust in terms of a per capita daily test rate, for instance?
No, there's no definition at all. When we asked about the definition, there has been no response. Because it's so vague. So what we did in Fort Lauderdale was we were able to secure an actual testing site in our own city. There had never been a test site established by the county anywhere east of I-95. So we worked with the governor's office, and for the last week and a half, we've had a testing site here in Holiday Park in Fort Lauderdale. We've been testing anywhere between 350 and 400 people per day since last week. And it's been great for us to kind of get a sense of what the impact is of this disease on our community. And so far, we've seen no increase in the incidence of this disease, and the statistics in terms of those who have contracted the disease and the number of people taking the test has remained low. So there again, staying within the statistical data. The statistical region that Dr. Fauci and the CDC have indicated would require us to achieve in order to move into phase one, we feel we've achieved that. Now, look, we're not talking about opening up the doors of every business and, and we're talking about a very measured approach.
Is the Fort Lauderdale phase one the same roughly or exactly as what the 64 other counties in Florida have been experiencing this year? In other words, the ability to open up public spaces, restaurants opening up at 25% capacity, bars remaining closed.
Bars will remain closed. But there's within our 28-page report, we go into greater detail than simply saying capacity allowances and things like that. Our restaurant, our capacity allowance is 50%, which is exactly the percentage that the governor's task force recommended when he assembled his task force.
Actually put into his executive
order.
His executive order, which was 25%, right? But you're willing to go 50% for Fort Lauderdale.
Well, and especially focusing on open air, while we still have great weather, we're even considering talking about closing off one lane on Las Olas Boulevard, for example, to allow tables and chairs to be set up on the streets and maintain that open air atmosphere. But the thing is that there's a lot, people don't want to be collecting unemployment insurance. People want to go back to work. The unemployment insurance experience has been inconsistent and it's been frustrating, and people are frustrated overall. They want to get back to some level of functionality, not normalcy, but functionality.
Let me ask you about some more specific pieces of the phased reopening for Fort Lauderdale. You talk about closing one lane of Las Olas. It's a two-lane road, if memory serves correct. You're going to go one way?
Correct. No. It's a four lanes, actually. And
I stand corrected. It's been a while since I've been out of my car, Mr. Mayor. I'll be honest with you. So so be it. Okay, fair enough. You're going to cut that down.
The one lane that's assigned for parking after 11 a.m. in the morning, that lane would be reserved for the
outdoor. What about hair salons, nail salons, barber shops, those types of businesses?
All of which are included in the report, all of which are allowed to be open, and all of which require very, very important safety measures. For example, in a hair salon, both the customer and the stylist will have to wear face masks, gloves on the stylist, an apron of sort. The importance, of course, is here to maintain safety.
Yeah. Any occupancy limitations on those businesses?
Yes, occupancy limitations, distancing requirements.
Okay.
Everything that you would expect, we want implemented.
How about movie
theaters?
The
thing is, we did not open movie theaters per se, but we are talking about museums, and as far as theater is concerned, like Broward Center, we're not there yet.
Okay.
So, but we're still working on
non-essential retail stores and shopping malls.
Non-essential retail, like the Galleria.
Yeah.
There's a protocol for opening the Galleria. So there are protocols that we've established based on a task force that we assembled of stakeholders, healthcare providers. We assembled a task force of about 25 people, all of whom contributed to the effort to try to come up with a plan once phase one, we became phase one eligible according to the CDC guidelines.
Mr. Mayor, let me ask you about the B question. That's the beach. You're going to open up the sand in phase one if you're successful in Fort Lauderdale.
No, the sand itself, allowing people to remain in place and congregate, is not contemplated in the phase one reopening. But the beach is considered available for walking and recreation, especially going in the ocean. But we're going to have to be kind of strict on that, too, because by the time you get from the parking space to the beach, people tend to congregate, and we're trying to make sure that people are distanced from each other.
Mr. Mayor, stick with us here. We want to talk a little bit more with you.
Sure.
The Fort Lauderdale Mayor, Dean Trentalis, is talking with us here on the South Florida Roundup. He wrote a letter to Governor Ron DeSantis asking for the governor to give special dispensation, essentially, to Fort Lauderdale and allow it to have its own phase one reopening of Fort Lauderdale. I want to go to WLRN Palm Beach reporter Wilkin Brutus is along with us. Wilkin, you've been monitoring the Palm Beach County Commission meeting. Pretty interesting vote that came down here on this Friday, 4-3 to tentatively reopen beaches in Palm Beach County.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about what this plan looks like?
Yeah, so the motion was split 3-3 with Mayor Koerner having the deciding vote. The commission ultimately agreed to a 4-3 to allow May 18th as the sort of tentative date to allow reopening of the beaches. And the commission will meet again May 15th to have a special meeting, which can also move up the reopening timeline or push it back.
And so any guidelines that it pointed to in terms of if it does reopen the beach? And also, what's the health information, the public health information that the commissioners who support reopening the beach are looking at, are resting on?
Yeah, so the motion was amended to allow only Palm Beach County residents access to the beach, which was sort of like a response to the fact that most commissioners were concerned about folks in the south, Miami-Dade and Broward County, coming up to take advantage of the reopening of the beaches. Commissioner McKinley also suggested that the beaches don't allow chairs and umbrellas. Commissioner Greg Weiss and Mac Bernard had issues reopening the beaches precisely because of the COVID-19 not being able to go down as consistently as the county has expected. And so far, that's the main concern from the dissenting commissioners.
Wilkin, hold the line here. Mayor Trentalis with Fort Lauderdale, your neighbors to the north, they're talking about reopening the sand, late next week. Is that going to provide a potential problem for Fort Lauderdale or Broward County if residents are seeking out seats on the sand in Palm Beach, congregating, only to come back into your community?
It shows how we're spreading mixed messages in South Florida, and that's not good for the community. It's not the way to run government, and certainly not the way to run any kind of county or city. I applaud Palm Beach County for taking the initiative based on scientific evidence that they are ready to reopen. We happen to be within that same realm of scientific evidence that would permit us to enter into phase one. People are just very cautious, and we get that. Yeah. But enforcement is going to be very difficult.
Yeah, Wilkin, right. did in Palm Beach County, did they discuss enforcement protocol if they do move forward with the reopening of Palm Beach beaches for residents?
Yes, County Administrator Virginia Baker did mention the fact that PBSO, Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, would enforce sort of the rules that would be enacted soon. And part of that main concern, too, from the public, I might add, is that ocean rescue EMTs and lifeguards expressed huge concerns about reopening the beaches because of the lack of social distancing operations intact with that sort of motion. And so there were a lot of dissenting voices from the public and a lot of supporting voices from the public. And so it was split throughout the entire commission.
WLRN's Palm Beach reporter Wilkin Brutus with us live here on this Friday. Fort Lauderdale Mayor Dean Trentalis, let me have the last word. Any response from the governor's office regarding your request for a phased reopening in Fort Lauderdale?
Well, I don't think it was any coincidence that in midweek the governor had a press conference in which he said he was prepared to start reopening South Florida sooner than he anticipated. So we'd like to think that we had some influence on
that. You think
that
you nudged him a little bit, maybe?
I hope so. And it's only the smart thing to do. We follow the science. The science tells us we're there. And at the same time, we have to recognize that the current status quo is unsustainable. It's just unsustainable, both economically, psychologically, and medically. And I think that, you know, as we continue to make progress, as our communities continue to respect the guidelines, I'm so proud of the people in my city and throughout our South Florida, people wearing masks, people being very respectful of one another. You know, this has really been a wonderful education for all of us to see how we can all get together and work together and make things happen.
Mr. Mayor, we're going to talk just about that issue, as a matter of fact, but we got to take a quick time out. But I thank you for your time. Thanks for sharing your thoughts there from the mayoral position there in Fort Lauderdale, Dean Trentalis. Mr. Mayor, thanks for joining us on the round. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
More to come here as South Florida is approaching the second weekend of open spaces for parks and golf courses and marinas, what to expect in the weekend ahead, and taking more of your phone calls as well. Please join us here on the Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. Well, it's been about 2 weeks that some parks and other outdoor spaces have been open across South Florida. It's been a bit of a rocky start in some popular spots. There were long lines of boaters at Black Point Marina and Homestead and Crandon Park on Key Biscayne for folks wanting to get out on the water on Biscayne Bay. The city of Miami Beach decided to close South Point Park. Police issued thousands of warnings for social distancing violations. WLRN asked listeners about their experience at parks.
My name is Luz Nazario, and I live in South Miami, and I'm glad to see that they've lifted a lot of the restrictions. Yeah, we've been to some of the parks in the afternoon when I go walking with my daughter, and we go around our block and to the park. We've taken our masks, but what we've noticed is that a lot of people are not wearing their mask and not keeping the 6 feet of social distancing.
Share your experiences with us. Have you visited a county park as they've reopened? Maybe hit the links or gone out on the water? Have you waited in line at the marina? Everybody behaving? Everybody recognizing 6 feet of distance, wearing masks when they need to? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 is our phone number. On the telephone to talk about enforcement of all this is the director of Miami-Dade Police, Freddie Ramirez. Director Ramirez, welcome to WLRN. Thanks for your time today, sir.
How are you, sir?
I am very well. I hope you and your officers are safe and healthy. How are they trained to deal with some of the social distancing violations that have been popping up as these open spaces have reopened?
Well, we work very well with our park services. Maria Nardi, who's the director, has put a great plan. We also have our school crossing guards out there. They're supporting along with our officers. And it's really our community policing model. You know, our goal is to make sure that the citizens of Miami-Dade County are safe while they're enjoying this opportunity to be out in our beautiful scenery and get some of that stress out. And we give them warnings. You know, we've had very few issues. Obviously, we have a lot of parks. Some of our parks are very populated. But our goal is to maintain a good relationship with the police at the same time ensuring their safety. So it's that balance, and we apply the practices that we teach our officers each and every day.
What do you make of those violations that you've seen in another agency, not the violations by the agency, but that Miami Beach Police witnessed in South Point Park specifically? What's your take on those violations and the number of incidents, number of violations and citations that were issued in Miami Beach, for instance?
Well, here in Miami-Dade County, we really haven't had that issue. I'm very proud of our community. Most people are adhering to the orders, and whenever we have an issue, it's corrected right away. We're not having any confrontations. I can't speak for other locations, but what sure. I can speak to is the 1.9 million citizens of Miami-Dade County who I feel, for the most part, are just as concerned and trying to adhere to the rules and also trying to enjoy life at the same time and during these very dangerous times with this virus.
Yeah, I want to ask about protecting your officers, but let me ask about the marinas first. We saw those long lines form in some cases late Friday night a week ago, early Saturday morning for folks who are just pining to get out on the water, and understandably so. Any change in direction for your officers and how they're going to deal with that kind of marina traffic that may come this weekend?
No, we're sticking to the plan that we have. From what I speak, and speaking to Maria Nardi, and she brings up a good point, we've always had...
She's the head of the Parks Department there in Miami-Dade County. Go ahead.
Yes. They've always had lines there because we only have a limited amount of marinas in Miami-Dade County. And in order to ensure so that there's no issues on the waterway, we're vetting each boat as they come on. We're putting one boat on the slip, making sure that the appropriate amount of people are on the boat per the size of the boat, and that they have their masks, and they head on their way. So it's a slow, methodical, but safe process. But unfortunately, in Miami-Dade County, we only have so many marinas. So it's a process. And given, you know, the patience that the citizens have had standing in those lines, and I know they want to get out there to those waterways, we haven't really had any issues. You know, it's just, unfortunately, we're limited to the amount of marinas we have, and safety is our paramount concern. And it's going to be methodical, and we will continue with that process.
What other lessons has the department learned from kind of the first weekend that maybe you're applying either in training or the approach of your officers into this second weekend and really ahead of Memorial Day, of course, which is, you know, I mean, Mother's Day this weekend and, of course, Memorial Day in a couple of weeks, weekends where South Floridians still tend to would like to get out and about and maybe congregate.
But what we're really seeing is that a lot of the community is policing itself. I mean, it's already part of the norm. It's like smoking in a business. You walk into a restaurant, start smoking, people are going to shun you. I think that it's already embedded into our culture. In the beginning, where we noticed some of our larger parks, like Tropical Park, we had to add some more officers to it just because of the sheer size and the demand of the community to be out there in the open spaces. And also some of our the fishing locations off the bridges, we had to tighten that up, which we did. We worked really well with the city of Miami, with our partners, and we haven't had any issues since. I mean, you know, you're talking about a whole lot of people that we're trying to coordinate so they can enjoy the vast amount of open spaces that we enjoy in this community, and it's been amazing, I feel. And a lot of it has to do that the community is pretty much on board with us.
Yeah. Have you or your officers had to issue any violations, do you know of? Or citations? Have your officers issued any citations for folks not following social distancing or wearing
masks? No, not at all. No, it's normally corrected right away. And the few times where there have been discussions, we educated them, parks did, and then our officers would come and back home. And that was in the early stages. Okay. And but it was not adversarial, nor am I seeking any adversarial confrontations over this. What we're seeking is compliance and safety. And like I said, for the most part, the community has adopted this. I think it's already in our culture, and I've seen it myself. Today, I went by the park. I had a lunch there, and everybody there had a mask on.
Is that right?
I went to Tropical Park yesterday with some of my command staff. The same thing. I saw one of my police cars drive by. Sir, please keep your mask on, or PA. I mean, you're just seeing it like systematic. And it's unfortunate that this is the world we live in right now, but we're doing what we have to do, and like I said, safety is paramount, and people are complying despite some of the commentary that you'll see out there, because we're big, can't be everywhere, but it takes all of us together to get through this and move through the stages of coming back to some sort of normalness.
Director Ramirez, let me ask you about the safety of your officers. How about the supply of personal protection equipment, and what direction are they under regarding the wearing of masks or even gloves as they encounter the public?
No, absolutely. We have very clear guidelines for them. We developed a 24-hour departmental safety officer line where they can ask questions. They have their PPE masks. We've gotten let's talk about the community. We've gotten so many donations to our department for masks, for all kinds of hand sanitizers, gloves. That really, it shows that despite we're out there telling people to keep social distancing and doing kind of like non-traditional policing, the community really appreciates what we're doing, and it builds up the stockpile for my officers and keeps them safe and their families safe.
So remember, you've got enough, Director. Yeah, you've got enough of those PPE.
Yes, we do. We track them. We have about over a month's worth. Last time I checked with our PPE masks, we had approximately 24,000 masks.
Yeah,
and we monitor that, and we had like 1,000 a day burn rate.
I was just going to ask about that. What are the officers? Are they using one per day, one per shift, one per public encounter, one per week?
One per shift. They follow the CDC guidelines on the box. That's what they do. And plus, they also have the non-surgical masks in between. They follow the CDC law enforcement guidelines of keeping the distance. They use it in the situations where they deem they need to use it.
Yeah.
And you see it in our numbers, in terms of our officers who tested positive. We have 10. They're in good spirits. But considering an agency of our size and the thousands of contacts that we make every day, I attribute that to, my officers being cognizant, safe, my frontline supervisors, and the support that this department and the community gives our people. That's why we've been very fortunate.
Director Ramirez, you mentioned 10 staff members that have tested positive for COVID-19. Any idea how many departmental folks are being quarantined, perhaps for possible exposure?
Oh yes, all the time. It's depending on the proximity. Yes, we'll quarantine between 20 and 30. They'll go through their appropriate testing modules, and they come right back to work. We follow up with them. We've already quarantined through this. There's been about 170 personnel, that's civilian and sworn, throughout this event that have gone through some sort of quarantine process. And I tell you, I think that even our standards of what we're doing for this has made it to the International Chiefs of Police website. That's the great work that my departmental safety officers have done. They've really like reinvented the position and probably created the blueprint for the future in terms of dealing with these issues.
Director Ramirez, really let me ask you one other quick question, and I'm up against a break here, so I apologize for interrupting you. Antibody testing is due to open up at Hard Rock Stadium for first responders and healthcare workers. Are you advising your deputies to get those antibody tests, even if they haven't been tested yet for the virus?
Yes, it's up to them. Whatever testing sites that are available for them, they're more than welcome to do that.
But they're under no orders to go do it, though.
No, I've given them a direct, I leave it up to them. And plus, they work in conjunction with our departmental safety officers who provide the guidance and guidelines for them to do what they need to do. But I certainly will not shun them from doing that.
Director Ramirez, appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for filling us in.
Thank you, sir. Have a good weekend, my friend.
You as well. Be safe. The director of the Miami-Dade County Police Department, Freddie Ramirez, here with us on the Roundup. Still to come, we're going to move away from COVID-19 talk and instead remember the coach, former Miami Dolphins coach Don Shula. He passed away this week. That's more on the Roundup. We're back on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's great to be here, and we feel honored. It's been 40 years, but what the hell, we still feel honored.
Former Miami Dolphins head coach Don Shula speaking at the White House in 2013. President Obama recognized Shula and the Dolphins for that 1972 perfect season. Yeah, a few years late, but recognition nonetheless. It's just one of the highlights of Shula's long and legendary career in football. He coached the Dolphins for 26 seasons and is the NFL's winningest coach. He reflected on that achievement in an interview with our news partner, the Miami Herald, in 2015.
Winning the most games, I think that there have been a lot of coaches that have coached over a period of time, a lot of great coaches. And to know now that my record, I won the most games, my teams have won the most games, and that's something I'm very proud of.
Shula passed away on Monday. He was 90 years old. We're taking a look back at his legacy here on the South Florida Roundup, and we're joined by Nat Moore via FaceTime audio. He's former wide receiver for the Dolphins, played with Coach Shula, played for Coach Shula. He's now the team's vice president for alumni relations. Nat, welcome to WLRN. Thanks for your time today, and our condolences on the loss for you and Coach Shula's family and your family. I imagine he was part of your family, do you think?
Yeah, he was not only a mentor and a coach to me, he was almost sort of like a second father. You know, the guy that taught you so much that during the days you played for him, that it helped you as you got into the real world and became a part of the community from a standpoint of trying to move on to your next profession.
You came into the Dolphin organization at quite a time, drafted by the Dolphins in 1974. The perfect season was capped off with that Super Bowl win in January of 1973. The Dolphins were riding high, and Coach Shula was at the tip of that peak. What was it like to join the team during those days?
Well, it was quite interesting because it was a team of professionals that never felt like they were going to lose. You know, I think my rookie year, we were 10-4 and got beat by the Raiders in the playoffs. But this was a team that every game until the clock sounded, they felt like they were going to win. There was a confidence factor. And the way that Coach Shula prepared us, you know, we were totally physically and mentally prepared for all situations. You know, he was one of the best at making sure that everybody understood what their job description was and what we were trying to accomplish on each and every play.
Take us into the locker room. Take us into the sidelines. Those days were different. There was no computer tablet on the sideline where you could, as a wide receiver, take a look at the defense schemes that the secondary were setting up, for instance. Film was actual film back then. It wasn't videotape. It was very much an analog game that the head coach and his voice was so much at the center of it. Take us over to the sidelines.
Yeah, I think that's true to a sense, but it was even more important what you did Monday through Saturday. You know, I used to always kid Coach Shula, he was the best coach in football Monday through Saturday. He said, well, hell, we play on Sunday. I said, yeah, but everything you do Monday through Saturday that gets us so prepared that when it's time to make adjustments on the field, doing the game, and et cetera, we're able to do that as a team and as a coaching staff because of what we've done Monday through Saturday in preparation. And, you know, he was one of those guys that would always come up with different things that he would like to try and do if indeed we bogged down. But, you know, we would have such trick plays that we might practice them in training camp and never practice them again. And then all of a sudden, here comes the hook and lateral against the San Diego Chargers. Mm-hmm. I mean, but that was the student of the game, and that was the idea that, you know, coach would always come up with a play at the right time that would give us that spark to move on and win the football game.
We're speaking with Nat Moore. He played for Coach Don Shula, of course, the winningest coach in NFL history, former Miami Dolphins coach, coach of the perfect season in 1972, and Coach Shula passed away this week at the age of 90. Nat, when you came into the Dolphins, again, in that kind of early to mid-70s, what did that team represent to South Florida at that time?
Well, it was big-time sports. You know, if you reflect back in the early 70s and late 60s, the Dolphins might have been the only sports team in the entire state of Florida. You know, I grew up in Miami. So, you know, I was in high school when the Dolphins came into existence, and to see them in a short span of time, especially after being so bad by 1973, to have won two championships, have been to three, you know, that's what Coach Shula did. He made South Florida sports relevant and really put us on the map.
Coach Shula came from Baltimore. He was, a northerner who came down here and found incredible success, but he came down as a winner, right?
Yeah, he had just, believe it or not, he had just lost the Super Bowl
right.
to the New York Jets right here in Miami, in the Orange Bowl.
That was the famous Joe Namath game.
That was Joe Namath's prediction, and because of that, the owner of the Baltimore coach was a little upset with him and traded him to the Dolphins and Joe Robbie. And that was the best thing that ever happened to South Florida sports. You know, he came in and just to show you what leadership means and et cetera, you know, before Don Shula came in 1970, you know, we had a bunch of misfits, guys that couldn't get out of their own way that, you know, just they couldn't win but 3 to 4 games a year. And in come Don Shula, and, you know, he sort of whipped them into shape and put some strategy in there and actually got them focused. And next thing you know, they're the best team in football. Oh, by the way, that was Bob Greasy, Larry Zonka, yeah. Larry Little, Jim Langer. Yeah. So all those guys were here. But when Coach came in, it changed the status and the way they looked at themselves.
Nat, I'll share just a short story. I grew up in the Midwest, and we were in the middle of Chicago Bears and Green Bay Packers territory. But when I saw a football card of the quarterback of the Miami Dolphins wearing glasses in full uniform talking to Coach Shula, as a kid who had to wear glasses since the age of 8 or 9, I thought, oh, well, maybe there is a future in this with for me. So Coach wasn't afraid to do those things, wasn't he?
No, Coach wasn't afraid. He you know, and the only time that Bob had any problems was if it started to rain, you know, and then he had to go back to the contacts. But, you know, realistically, I played with Bob along that time, and we won a lot of football games, you know.
Yeah.
I think the most amazing thing is that when you go back and you look at Coach Shula's record, and regardless of how many players he was fortunate enough to have, two Hall of Fame quarterbacks doing his career here with the Dolphins, and then he also had Johnny Unitas in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, in 1982, he takes us to the Super Bowl with David Woodley and Don Schrock. So, mm-hmm. you know, he had that ability to win games no matter what. And I would guarantee you that, you know, you can count on one hand how many times he had a losing season.
How did he feel about those Super Bowls after 1973? It's a rare occurrence to be able to get there, and the Dolphins got there a few more times but came up short while he was on the sidelines.
Well, he was frustrated, and of course, you know, the goal is once you get there and you lose, Now it's all about getting back to the Super Bowl. And, you know, it's hard to get there. You know, winning is hard. I don't care what anybody tells you. You know, it's difficult. You know, the as they like to say, the other guys get paid too. So in the process, it just comes down to hard work, putting forth the effort, and then letting the results take care of themselves. And even more so, the opportunity that once you get there, you've got to, you got to get the job done. And we just didn't do it. We went back-to-back, I shouldn't say back-to-back, but 82, and we drafted Dan Marino in 83, yep. Went back in 84, and haven't been back since then, just to show you how difficult it is to get there.
Yeah. And what was it like in the locker room after those games? What was his guidance like as a mentor, and what was he like as a motivator?
Well, I mean, I think as a mentor, he'd let you know that this ain't the feeling you want to, look forward to. This is not a good feeling when you lose that final game. We've got to get back to the drawing board. We've got to get back to this game and atone for it. And in 1982, after we lost to the Redskins, we started making some changes, and we worked hard. And we got back there in 84, but then we got beat by New England in the AFC Championship in 85, where we had a chance to go back and maybe play the Bears for the Super Bowl Championship. So, all you can do is try and motivate. You bring in new players. You try and figure out what they do best. And that's another thing with Coach Shula, was that he adapted his strategy, his offensive and defensive philosophy, to the talent we had, versus trying to put in a system that didn't fit the players.
Coach Shula is obviously perhaps best known outside of Miami for the perfect season, coaching the perfect season, and rightfully so. His reputation here goes well beyond being a football coach, of course, entrepreneur, community-minded individual. But this attitude of hard work, of perseverance, where do you think that came from for Coach Shula? And how did that get associated with him?
I think it came from his upbringing. His dad was a hard worker, and that's what he knew. And, growing up in Ohio, he learned certain traits. And then when he played football, it was the same thing. He had a chance to play for some of the great coaches, and then he studied under Paul Brown. I mean, a lot of times
Paul Brown, a very famous Cleveland Brown coach, I think, from the early days of the NFL.
Right, he played for Paul Brown, and then he coached under him. So, I mean, a lot of times you take on the onset of your leader if you think he's leading you the right way. And my greatest tribute to Coach Shula, being a local kid growing up here, and it's forget the football. I mean, he was the best there was at it. But he always was involved in the community. He was always the first guy to say, hey, let's go do this. He made sure that his players had interaction with the community and the fans. I remember in the 70s and 80s, there used to be a partnership between the NFL and United Way. Mm-hmm. And this was this tremendous partnership. And they would come in and pitch us to donate to United Way to support a lot of the youth agencies that we all came through. And Coach Shula was always, always the first guy to write a check. He was the first guy to stand up and give a check. And, when you got a leader that leads that way, the rest of the players eventually start to get it. And if you look at South Florida and how many guys came here, played under him, and became such an intricate part of the community, they never left. And they have businesses that are flourishing, and they're intricate parts of this South Florida community.
Nat, let me ask you, as the head of alumni operations for the Miami Dolphins now, and of course you came up through that system, as you mentioned, raised here in South Florida as well. In today's organization for the Dolphins, where do you see Don Shula's fingerprints?
I think it's all over. I mean, we're at Hard Rock Stadium, but we're only there because Don Shula came in and turned us into this juggernaut of a winning football franchise. That at some point we needed a new stadium, and Hard Rock was built. And then you turn around and you look at how Nova Southeastern and all these folks gravitated because they wanted a piece of the Miami Dolphins. So when you think of everything that the Miami Dolphins are right now, Don Shula has been the patriot for the Miami Dolphins for the last 50 years.
Obviously, the season here in 2020 is uncertain because of the virus. What can you share with us, if anything, Nat, in terms of planning or hopes for some kind of honor for the coach?
Well, I can't say for sure what we're going to do. We don't know. So much is predicated on the pandemic and at what point this thing becomes less of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure that we will do something. We haven't really decided as of yet as an organization. But you can rest assured that the Miami Dolphins basically do have Coach Shula and his family in our plans and our hearts.
Nat, would you feel comfortable sharing with us the last conversation or what you spoke about last time you were able to spend time with Coach Shula?
I think the last time I actually spent any real time with him, I was at his 50th, I mean his 90th birthday party, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
We did a nice little party on that Saturday night and, surprised him for the first time ever. I mean, Marianne did an outstanding job of keeping him in the dark where he thought he was just going to go out and grab something to eat and everything and eat at home. And then when he got there, we had the perfect season team and a whole bunch of other players that were part of his history. And I thought that was a great night. And it was just good to see him happy, you know. Of course, I was with him at the owner's party where, once again, he had another fun night, and we were even kidding him that he was trying to dance and sitting in his wheelchair. So, he was just a lovable guy. You know,
yeah.
I mean, during the time you played for him, because he drove you so hard, you were always angry or upset. You want to know why he pushed you so hard. But then, as you get out in the real world and you see how he's prepared you for the tough times, then you realize even more so how good he was for you.
Nat, we appreciate you spending as much time as you have here with us on WLR and remembering Coach Shula. I thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure.
And again, my condolences to you and your friends and family and the Shulas, of course, and the Dolphins organization. Nat Moore has been with us. Nat played for Coach Shula in the 70s and 80s from Miami, and Nat now is still with the Miami Dolphins as the Vice President of Alumni Relations. Finally, on the roundup this week, it wasn't the winning, though that made a big impression. It wasn't the longevity, though that was remarkable. It was the determination, the workmanship, the grit, the genuineness of Don Shula, why a kid from Iowa fell for the Miami Dolphins and Coach Shula. You know, in the Midwest where I grew up, I was among the black and blue division of the NFL. It was the Bears and Packers, the gray days along Lake Michigan or the frozen tundra of Green Bay. That was football season. When I saw the Dolphins play on television, it was the sun-splashed vivid colors of South Florida on display with Coach Shula on the sidelines. I'll admit that I'm not really much of a football fan anymore, but I'll always be a Shula fan. For the winning, sure, that's easy, but also for the classy way that he did it.
Miami has the Dolphins, the greatest football team. We take the ball from goal to goal like no one's ever seen.
WLRN asked you to share your memories of the former Dolphins coach.
Growing up, I didn't even know anyone else was allowed to coach the Dolphins. You were the perfect head coach for South Florida, and you'll never be replaced. Rest in peace, Coach Shula.
He just had a way about him that when you talk with him, he made you feel like he's known you your whole life.
Sports in our house was priceless moments because we would gather around and we will watch the Miami Dolphins football. I am so sad. And thank you, Coach Shula, for some wonderful memories. And we love the Dolphins. We love the Dolphins.
Scott Shapiro, Joe Donzelli, and Sunday Phillips talking about their memories of Don Shula and the Miami Dolphins. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio programming at WLRN is Jason Zabka. The director of radio operations and our technical supervisor this hour is Peter J. Meritz. Richard Ives answers the phones for us. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting WLRN. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Miami Dolphins number one.